What do you get when you mix social unrest, LSD, the Book of Revelations, and the Beatles? Well, 44 years ago this week, the city of Los Angeles and the entire nation discovered the answer in the shockingly brutal murders of seven people over the course of two nights. The Tate-LaBianca murders and subsequent arrest, trial, and conviction of Charles Manson and his followers gripped the nation's attention for the next 2 years, and this story remains a powerful memory for many of us. What was it about this uneducated, manipulative con man that enabled him to get others to do whatever he asked them? And what is it about the Manson family that continues to fascinate and repel? For his latest book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, Jeff Gwynn interviewed those closest to the man, his adoptive sister and his first cousin. They had never spoken to the media about the Charles Manson they knew. The book, which brings many new facts to light, is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jeff Gwynn to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
There have been countless books and TV documentaries about the Manson family, including Vincent Bugliosi's award-winning Helter Skelter, but when did you realize that there was a lot to the story that was still untold?
I wanted to write a book that captured America in the late 1960s, and it was a very chaotic, confusing time. And when I write these books, I try to find an iconic individual.
Well, you wrote the autobiography of Santa Claus, so you can't get more iconic than that.
Well, from Santa Claus to Charlie Manson, it's your basic career path for a writer,
Bonnie,
I guess.
Bonnie and Clyde in the middle.
That's true. All interesting folks. But the thing that fascinated me about Manson is that all the books that have been written, he's almost arriving full-blown in Los Angeles, some kind of manipulative monster. And I thought, the man is in his 30s then. How did we grow this individual? And if there had been a book that had explained all that, I wouldn't have written this one.
You refer to Charles Manson as the wrong man in the right place at the right time.
Very much so. When you talk about Manson to people, a lot of them say, oh, he's a product of the 60s. Well, he is, but he's also a product of the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. And all through his life, and now we know for a fact, going back to his first days in elementary school, he was manipulative, and he got other people to do his dirty work.
Well, you got you talked to a number of the relatives,
right,
who had refused to talk to the press before. Why now?
It was hard to find these folks. His sister Nancy, his cousin Joanne, have spent 44 years trying not to be found. When I was able to track them down, I sent them registered letters. This is who I am. This is the kind of book I want to write. I asked if I could send them some of my previous books. We talked on the phone a few times, and then they both ended up inviting me to come see them. They were so helpful, and we even have everything from Manson's baby pictures to his wedding photos now.
Were you able to talk to any members of the cult?
Yes, I was. Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, both in the California Institution for Women.
And what about Charlie himself, or Chucky, as he was called when he was a kid?
Well, they tried calling him Chucky, but he wasn't a very lovable child, and they would end up screaming Charles at him. For 5 months, I wrote Manson a letter a day asking if he would see me. Most of his visiting privileges had been curtailed because he'd been caught with unauthorized cell phones and also a shank. 78 years old, and he's still doing these things.
It's hard to believe that the sweet-faced boy on the cover of this book is the same Charles Manson we're talking about. He looks really like he must have been a nice kid.
Well, he looked like one, but he wasn't one. And one of the things people don't realize about Manson is he's tiny. He's 5'4" now and weighs about 120 pounds. He looked more like an elf than a little boy.
He has often talked about how terrible his childhood was, but you discovered that that was largely a fabrication?
He's lied just about everything, and particularly his childhood. He was not the bastard child of an unwed teenage prostitute. He was brought up pretty much in luxury.
Although his mother was sent to jail for armed robbery.
Well, she was, and it was the most spectacularly bungled attempted holdup, I think, in the history of West Virginia crime. She was
the ketchup bottle holdup, they called it.
They made fun of her and Charlie's uncle in the newspapers, the ketchup bottle bandits, they called them. She was in prison for about 3 years, but during that time, Manson lived with his uncle, aunt, and cousin, and lived very nicely, I might add, in McMeekin, West Virginia.
He was how old, around 5 or so?
He was 5 then. His mother got out of prison when he was about 8. By 10, he was so incorrigible. He would not go to school, shoplifting, all sorts of things, that he was finally taken to a facility for boys. Again, not the type of Fagin-like existence he pretends, though.
But he did have a terrible teacher, a teacher that everybody hated, named Mrs. Varner.
We do.
Did it have a real impact on him?
Well, Mrs. Varner to this day is remembered with dread by the senior citizens in McMeekin. But again, that was just one isolated incident. She liked to pick on kids, particularly boys. She picked on Charlie one day. He went back to his aunt and uncle's house crying. McMeekin boys aren't supposed to act that way. The next day, his uncle made him wear one of his cousin's dresses and took him back to school.
Because he was calling him a sissy.
Right. And that one story that Manson tells, yes, that one was true. But everything else, no.
Now, his sexuality was a bit ambiguous in later years. Was his uncle picking up on something?
No, I don't think so. His Uncle Bill was simply one of those tough men of those times.
Manson's cousin Joanne remembers Charles as obsessed with being the center of attention and then also being prone to violent rages. She said he liked to start trouble and then let somebody else get blamed for it.
The story that she told me that made the hair on my arms stand up is Charlie's in first grade. And he talks some of the girls in his class into beating up a boy he doesn't like. When the principal comes to get Charlie, Charlie says, it's not his fault. The girls were doing what they wanted. It's not his responsibility. The same defense he'll use all those years later for Tate LaBianca.
At 12, he went to the first of six reform schools, got out at 19, got married, became a father, and then he sent back to prison.
Charlie started out stealing cars and graduated to being an extremely low-level pimp. That was his goal when he was in prison, to learn from the more successful pimps, so they couldn't have been that successful if they were in jail with him.
So learning how to be manipulative was important. He also, you say, was very influenced by Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
This is just so amazing. He took a Dale Carnegie course in prison. And I talked to a couple of his prison mates who said that back in his cell, he would practice the lines from Dale Carnegie. When I met Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel interviewing them in prison, I said, how did Charlie approach you? What were the things that he said that got you interested in him? And they told me everything, word for word, chapter 7 in How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Didn't he also have a little flirtation with Scientology?
Not for any religious conviction. Simply, he was interested in how they recruited followers to that particular faith.
So where was he living? Where did he go to? Where was he sent to prison?
First in California, then McNeil Island in Washington State. He finished up his prison career, the first one, at Terminal Island just outside Los Angeles.
So how did he wind up in Berkeley?
He got out of prison. He's paroled. He didn't want to get out. He actually told them that he would not be able to function on the outside. When he got out, somebody he'd known in prison was living in Berkeley and told Charlie there was work up there. He went to Berkeley, but, of course, fell in love with all the possibilities of Haight-Ashbury.
Well, we're talking about the period of peace and love, a lot of political thinking, free speech. He doesn't seem to be the perfect fit for that.
Charlie Manson is a chameleon, and he is able to take on whatever persona will work in a given situation. He himself bragged that he was the man of 1,000 hats. He could change hats or personalities instantly. It was no trouble at all. He modeled himself after the corner gurus in Golden Gate Park. He's cribbed their best lines and then went out and used them himself.
Wasn't part of his appeal his songwriting abilities?
His songwriting abilities were more limited than people actually believe.
Well, he did write a song that the Beach Boys later recorded with some changes. He called it Cease to Exist. But the Beach Boys, although, Never Learn Not to Love?
Never Learn Not to Love. Dennis Wilson, who Charlie had been living with, then listed himself as the composer so he could make a few bucks back. Charlie had mooched off him for a long time.
He changed the lyric from Cease to Exist, which sounds very 60s, to Cease to Resist, which sounds more Manson-like than Manson was willing to say.
If he had left the lyrics alone, Charlie would not have sought revenge afterwards. But Charlie did not want anyone to change his lyrics.
Well, we have to go into a break, and I thought it might be fun to hear Charles Manson singing Cease to Exist.
cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, you can't be. I'm your kind. Oh, your kind, I can see. Walk on, walk on. I love you, pretty girl. My life's yours. Cease to resist. Come say you love me. Give up your world. Come be with me. I'm your kind. I'm your kind, and I see. Come on.
We're back with Jeff Gwynn, whose previous books include The Last Gunfight, the real story of the shootout at the OK Corral and how it changed the American West, and Go Down Together, the true untold story of Bonnie and Clyde, which was a finalist for the Edgar Award in 2010. His latest, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And we just heard the Beach Boys version of that Charles Manson song with darker lyrics. In fact, they would scare me a lot more than the song that Charles Manson sang.
Well, unfortunately, when Charlie sang, Charlie was still in the room. And in person, he was quite something. Just listening to that music reminded me of a story that Patricia Krenwinkel told me. When Charlie was getting ready to record, a friend of the Beach Boys booked some studio time. Charlie was sure this was going to be it. He was going to be a huge star, and recorded Cease to Exist. In the back, you can hear a female chorus. And Charlie had insisted that all the women in the family had to sing along, and several of them were terrible singers. And so between takes, Charlie is threatening them with violence if they don't start singing on key. So the final result, well, it sounds pretty good, but it was probably the 20th take.
How did the rest of the Beach Boys react to Manson? Did they think that Dennis, the drummer brother, was hooking up with the wrong crowd?
Oh, they hated Manson. They had been involved for quite a while with the Maharishi and had just come back from a disastrous tour where they would have the Maharishi on stage before they'd perform, and the Maharishi kept getting booed off the stage. So Dennis showing up with someone he claims is a new guru was bad enough. And then this very dirty, unkempt guy who's not a great musician is expecting that the Beach Boys will sign him to their labels and make him a superstar.
Well, one of the ways that he lured people into his circle was by offering the services of his cult followers.
Very much so. Manson was open with the women in his family. They were there to provide sex to whatever men he was trying to get to help him.
What were some of the qualities that Manson looked for in a new recruit?
He said over and over, and we've heard this from people, he wanted to find young people who were bent but not completely broken, that were looking for someone to tell them what to do, and that he would fit that.
And that's why he called his group the Family.
Actually, the nickname of the Family came about. Greg Jacobson, a friend of Dennis Wilson's, called them that. They had initially called themselves the Trolls.
It sounds like a rock group.
If Charlie could have gotten on a label with that name, yep, he would have done it.
At some point, Manson met Neil Young. What did he think of Manson?
Neil Young admits that he was probably the one who appreciated Manson and liked his music the most. He tried to talk his label, Warner, into signing Manson, but that didn't work. To this day, Manson says Neil Young was the only famous person who was ever decent to him after the fact. He even gave Manson a motorcycle.
Manson was notoriously racist and sexist, which went against the image that he was constructing. How did he hide that side from everyone?
Well, he didn't hide it from everyone. He was trying to recruit bikers as sort of his personal militia. And he would tell the women in his family, well, I'm just talking this racist stuff, because that's what they want to hear. I don't believe it myself. But in fact, he was a terrible racist and even in prison would refuse to talk to black or Hispanic inmates.
At the same time, he was a Beatles fan, and the Beatles represented the total opposite, didn't they?
Well, Manson, like many others at that time, believed that the Beatles songs were actually a cultural roadmap. Before the White Album and Helter Skelter, which is what he called then the racial apocalypse that was supposedly going to come, he was hung up on the Magical Mystery Tour album. And in fact, that's why they had their school bus and they would travel around the country. Manson would say, we're on a Magical Mystery Tour.
Although he also claimed that he was going to be bigger than the Beatles.
Well, he told his followers that when this race war came about, he and the family would hide in a bottomless pit in the desert. The blacks would win the race war, but would be unable to govern themselves. So when the war was over, the family would emerge and they would rule the world.
And he also compared himself to Jesus.
Well, he sometimes said he was a reincarnation of Jesus.
The most powerful person that Manson met from the record industry was Terry Melcher, the son of Doris Day and one of the top producers of the time. What was Melcher's opinion of Manson and his musical talent?
Melcher was a very, very good friend of Dennis Wilson's, and he eventually listened to Manson perform more as a courtesy than anything else. He personally didn't like Manson, though he was quite attached to one of Manson's followers, Ruth Ann Moorhouse, and in fact wanted to bring the girl home to be his housekeeper on Cielo Drive. His girlfriend at the time turned that down. Melcher ultimately listened to Manson perform and said to his friends later there was absolutely nothing original about him. He sounded like a million other long hairs imitating the Beatles.
And didn't Manson at one point send him a bullet?
Dennis Wilson. He left a bullet for Dennis after Dennis didn't want Manson living with him anymore.
Now, Dennis died in a rather mysterious boating accident. Has anyone tried to connect the Manson people to that?
No, and Dennis was drunk and on drugs at the time, so it was a drowning. Manson later made it clear that it happened because that was what he had wanted to happen, and his wishes always come true.
What is your sense of when Manson crossed the line and started believing in his own rap, when he conjured up the idea of the coming race war and the hole in the desert?
He didn't believe any of that, I'm sure. It's wrong to assume that Charles Manson was in any way insane, or for that matter, that he's stupid. It's true he was uneducated, but in fact, he was simply a great manipulator. Surely he didn't think, and I'm not only convinced of this, Vincent Bugliosi is convinced of it, now Krenwinkel and Van Houten, we've all talked about this at length. He never really believed that there was going to be this apocalyptic race war. What he hoped would happen with the Tate and LaBianca murders, if it could be made to appear the work of black militants, there might at least be another race riot in Los Angeles. Then Manson can point to that and tell his followers that this is the kind of event that he can bring about.
But before those killings, wasn't there the murder of a drug dealer known as Lotsapapa?
Well, he tried to murder him. He failed. Manson thought he had shot Lotsapapa, who claimed to be a Black Panther, and if Charlie didn't pay for the drugs, that the money he owed, that the Black Panthers were going to descend on him. Manson thought he'd killed Lotsapapa, and only after Manson was in custody for Tate LaBianca did he pass Lotsapapa in the L.A. jail, saw that he was alive, and said, "Hey, man, sorry, but you know how it is."
Mm. Well, why did he choose the house on Cielo Drive for the first murders? That's where Terry Melcher had lived, but he no longer lived there.
Manson wanted to have these murders committed on famous rich people. He thought that was the way he would get the most attention. The reason they picked that house, Melcher didn't live there anymore, but Tex Watson, who drove that night and orchestrated the killings physically, had been to Melcher's house too. He knew how to get there in the middle of the night, and that's why they picked that house.
Well, one of the mysteries for me at the time was, okay, it's one thing to convince your followers to roll around in the desert and have orgies. That was all because they were getting stoned. It's another thing to convince people to go out and commit murder.
Very much so. But you have to remember, this wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing. Manson was always careful to keep his followers as isolated as he could. Spahn Ranch and then out in the Mojave Desert. And they were treated 24/7 to philosophy according to Charlie. between the drugs and certainly the fact that he was telling them, this is how you're going to prove that you are special, you are superior. And it's not really murder because life and death are the same thing. After a while, there were enough of them who took him at his word and followed his orders.
How did he react when Tex Watson and the others reported back to the Spahn Ranch?
This was one of the things that Patricia Krenwinkel told me that had never really been reported before. The women who went that night had not known they were going to kill anybody. Watson only told them when they had climbed the fence and were on the property. They thought they were going to steal things instead. Charlie wanted them to leave signs that it was Black Panthers. That's why they had the word piggy and blood. They were trying to give this impression. But when they got back to Spahn Ranch, Manson was waiting for them, and he grilled them. What did you do? How did you leave the bodies? When they told him, he didn't think it was good enough. He got in the car, drove back to the house, and rearranged things. Krenwinkel said she didn't know for sure that he'd done that until the trial, when they're showing pictures of the crime scene and they're saying, wait a minute, that wasn't there, that wasn't there. Manson stage managed the whole thing.
And that's never come out until now?
Nope. There was one book supposedly that Manson himself wrote with an ex-con named Newell Emmons that alluded to the fact that he went driving afterward. But this was the first time that we'd had somebody come out and say this is exactly how it occurred.
So they killed Sharon Tate and the people who were in her house.
Right.
And then they also killed the Rosemary LaBianca. Why the second murder?
Again, Manson was trying to see that rich people were killed. When the first night is over, and the next day there's no reports about the Black Panthers committing this atrocity, he's going to have them do it again. The LaBiancas lived in a fairly well-to-do neighborhood in California, certainly a place that Manson would have considered mansion-like. And the family had attended parties that were given next door to them. So again, it's going to a place that they knew how to get to in a rich neighborhood.
Although they didn't know these people at all.
No, they did not.
You say that Manson was feeling pressure as the family's leader to produce bigger and bigger miracles all the time to match up with his boast that he was really Jesus Christ.
You've got to remember, when a lot of the family members first attach themselves to Charlie, he takes them to Los Angeles. They end up living in Dennis Wilson's luxury mansion. But gurus have to constantly produce miracles. And the family's getting poorer and poorer. They're out in the desert a lot of the time suffering. And then Manson openly wants this record deal and gets turned down. He had to do something to reestablish control and to convince his followers that he really was the most powerful person in the world.
Why do you think this story continues to fascinate a lot of people?
Because Manson knows how to manipulate the media and the public. Just before his arrest for Tate LaBianca, he gathered his followers and told them that if he's ever arrested, he's going to put on his crazy Charlie act to convince everyone that he's insane, and they'll let him go. And to this day, Krenwinkel, Van Houten, they say what we're seeing is an act, Crazy Charlie, and he's been doing it now for 44 years.
How much do you think the murders are also the result of Manson's discontent about never making it big in the music business?
If Manson had been signed to a recording contract, he was convinced he would then have become a rock and roll superstar. That didn't happen. So sure, if he got signed to a record deal, he probably would not have felt the necessity of ordering his followers to kill someone.
He said when he was arrested that it was okay if he went to prison. He already understood how to live in prison. Do you think that he is having a good time in prison?
He seems to be. He wrote me one letter and also let me use some of his prison artwork in my book. He has current followers who visit him and who have talked to me, and apparently he's very happy.
Current followers? I mean, people who have come to him after he was sent to prison?
That's right. If you went out to Corcoran State Prison on any given day, you might see some pup tents outside. People actually camp out there in hopes
Young that people?
People of all ages, hoping that Manson will be released and come back to lead them. I get lots of emails and letters from his followers who aren't happy about the book. They're out there, and there's quite a few.
He carved a swastika into his forehead. Is it still visible?
In the pictures, it is. I never got to see him in person. I did see the back of a pew in a Nazarene church in McMeekin where he'd carved his initials as a boy.
Hey, you spoke to former followers.
Right.
Have they totally rehabilitated?
Some of them have, I think, and some of them haven't. It's very hard to tell. Quite a few have become fundamentalist Christians and see themselves as the second coming of Paul, spreading the word of the Lord. So that's certainly an interesting juxtaposition.
Well, one of the followers who didn't participate in the murders, Lynette Squeaky Fromm, she was sent to life in prison because she tried to kill President Gerald Ford.
And she was paroled a little while back and was spotted in a car in upstate New York with a pagan bumper sticker.
Now, she was sent to a prison in Fort Worth, which is where you live. Did you ever get to meet her?
She had been moved out of the facility just before I started writing the book, and I tried to contact her, and she was not interested in talking. Several of the former family members would have talked to me more, but they wanted to be paid. $25,000 was the usual asking price, but I never pay for interviews.
Do you think that you would have found out other interesting details? Because there are an awful lot of details here that fill in the blanks. And, of course, you give us a whole other sense of his childhood, something quite different from what everybody said. Vincent Bugliosi believed that his mother had been that Manson was born out of wedlock and his mother was a teenage prostitute, which turns out not to be true.
One of the people I'm most grateful to in this book is Vincent Bugliosi, who could not have been kinder or more helpful to me as I was doing my research. He pointed me in some different directions, got me in touch with some people, and yes, he was surprised at a lot of what I've learned. There's always going to be more. No book is ever definitive, but I hope with this book we've at least taken away a lot of the mysticism of Manson. Maybe it's his demystification.
Well, he pushed that mysticism, didn't he? I mean, even writing a lyric like "Cease to Exist" is pushing mysticism.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Manson did not want me writing this book, and I don't think he's going to like it. I am trying to send him one, but he's not allowed to receive books with hardcovers, so he might have to wait for the paperback.
Is Terry Melcher still alive?
No, Terry Melcher died of cancer some years ago.
So you weren't able to speak to any of those people?
But I was, because Greg Jacobson, who worked with Terry Melcher signing up bands and recording sessions, again, was very helpful to me and got me in touch with quite a few other people. I actually got to hear Manson's original tapes. And frankly, it sounds like he's forcing some unhappy women to sing along in the background.
But I could hear in his guitar playing the influence of Neil Young.
That wasn't him playing guitar.
Oh.
That was Bobby Beausoleil, a friend of his.
One of the members of the
family. He was never a member of the family, though he committed a murder that led to the later nights of murder with the family members. Manson is a very rudimentary guitar player. I didn't find anybody anywhere who heard him play guitar who thought he was in any way a gifted musician.
He picked it up in prison?
Actually, he picked it up in McMeekin. He liked to pick out tunes on the family piano, too. And when I say family piano, I'm talking about his uncle and aunt's house, not Spahn Ranch.
So the members of the family that you were able to talk to that who had not talked to anybody else up until now, are they still hiding from the connection?
Part of my agreement with them is I would identify them by first name only, no physical descriptions, and not describe what part of the country they even live in. They were wonderful folks to talk to. The pictures you see in the book, they pulled out of their family albums, and so these have never been seen before.
And as I said, there is this very sweet-looking young man on the cover of the book. How old is he at the time?
He's 13. He may be sweet-looking, but on that day, he walked into a courtroom and convinced a judge that he was Catholic. And so the judge sent him to Boys Town rather than a reformatory. He was in Boys Town for 3 days before he stole a priest's car and headed out for the West Coast.
Well, so he was consistent.
You've got to give Charlie credit. He was always good at conning.
And then he was caught. Well, a 13-year-old kid driving a priest's car probably would be pretty easy to spot.
Yeah, I think they got him in Utah.
Jeff Gwynn will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Strand Bookstore at 828 Broadway. That's at 12th Street. What are you planning to do now? Now you've done Bonnie and Clyde and Charles Manson.
Well, I'm so fascinated by the 60s and 70s and this whole guru thing. My next book is going to be about someone Charles Manson would have loved to be, and that is Jim Jones.
Jeff Gwynn's latest book is Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
It was a pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, New Yorker staff writer Ariel Levy talks about how social media and online communities are changing how crimes are solved and prosecuted. And then we'll take a look at the fossils of two dinosaurs locked in battle that were discovered in Montana in 2006 and are set to be auctioned to the highest bidder. Mark Slauka on his novel, Brewster, set in 1968. It traces an unforgettable friendship between two teenage boys. We'll also take a look at America in the mid-19th century when people were settling the West and finding new freedom there, even as the country fought bitterly over slavery. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. And we had help today from Helen Rauner, Todd McGovern, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.